This program spends much of its time discussing wars and the rumours of wars, and tonight we've got a beauty for you. It's the World War involving pallets. When our American friends packed up and left us once the war in the Pacific was over, they left behind quite a lot of good stuff, including at least 60,000 wooden pallets. Now, these had been indispensable for getting supplies of all sorts, of all things, to the Americans while they were here. Now, these pallets, along with a number of forklifts, were handed over to the Australian government, and I didn't realise this. They became part of the Commonwealth Handling Equipment Pool, otherwise known as CHEP. Now, in 1958, CHEP was privatised. It became a subsidiary of Brambles and is now the largest pallet business in the world. But over the last few years, CHEP has found itself in court in the US on any number of occasions. And to find out why, I'm joined via pallet and forklift by Brooklyn-based writer Jacob Hodes. Jacob has written very engagingly and amusingly about the pallet business in America, and I welcome him to our little wireless program. Good on you, Jacob. What possessed you to tackle this as a topic?
Okay. Thanks for having me. I think just pure journalistic desperation, you know, looking around for a good story.
I mean, you were that desperate? I mean, it's paid off because what you've discovered is so funny and so extraordinary. I found it exhilarating, but why? You know, I still find it enigmatic that someone with your background could have tripped over a pallet.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a bit of personal history. Back when I was in college, I spent part of a summer working in a factory and found myself palletizing. It was eyeglass cases that were being made in my hometown, and my job was to put these cardboard boxes onto the pallet and wrap the whole thing up with shrink wrap, which is another great topic. Industrial strength.
We'll do. I think we'll do shrink wrapping next week.
You really ought to. Yeah, but I don't know. From there, it went on this little list I have of everything in the world that might be interesting, which I have kind of methodically been going through. But once you start looking into it, you realize, oh God, there is a whole world here of personality and controversy and. It opens up quite a bit about how the global economy works.
It seems only yesterday that John Kenneth Galbraith was a regular on our program, and it was always a delight to talk to him. And, of course, he revealed at one point that the pallet industry was one of the two fastest growing in the US. When and how did all this happen? What's the history of the humble pallet?
Yeah, well, the prehistory is pretty much lost to us. But what we know is that in the early 20th century, the sort of leading edge companies here in the U.S. were experimenting with how to make their warehouses more efficient, how to move things around more quickly. And they realized that you could do so with pallets and the predecessors to the forklift, which were these big, bulky machines that I describe them kind of as heavy-duty golf carts with this sort of spatula thing protruding from the front. And they would scoop things up and move them around the warehouse. So this was being done at a small scale here. And then when World War II came along, that was the first time when there was a real sort of concentrated attention to the problem of what became known as materials handling.
Well, as you point out, the challenge of keeping 8 million GIs supplied was, quote, the most enormous single task of distribution ever accomplished anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. So that's when suddenly, you know, there's a shortage of manpower and a need to move all this stuff quickly, and it becomes a matter of life and death, literally. So once the U.S. Navy starts studying the issue, they realize pretty quickly that they can make things a lot more efficient by using pallets in combination with forklifts.
I learn from you that a fine organisation entitled, and I take a deep breath, the National Wooden Pallet and Container Association came into existence after the war. How many shipping pallets do you estimate the U.S. has these days?
Well, the numbers vary, but the best estimates are around 2 billion in circulation.
I'm rendered silent,
it's
which is on you. It's a lot of pallets.
And they're everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, when they're in trucks, they're also, you know, coursing their way through factories. They're on the assembly line. They're in warehouses. They're in back behind the supermarket. They're in trash heaps. There are probably some in your basement.
I've got quite a few at the farm where we use them to, to handle product. But also, they provide a cheap source of timber for fixing things. You know, and that's of course one of the things that happened to old pallets, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I've got a couple myself now. You know, and they're just good to have around.
Okay, you describe the pallet business in America as not just an industry, but a sprawling anarchic ecosystem. And those pallets were initially known as whitewood. We'll get onto the blue chips later. Tell us about whitewood.
Yeah, so after the war, many people come out of the war experience who worked in logistics and start this industry where they supply pallets to large manufacturers. And it's a fairly straightforward thing. You sell the pallet goes on and does its thing. When I think things really get interesting is in the 1970s, when the whole economy here has been palletized, and the problem becomes quite evident at that point that the pallets don't go away. They start piling up everywhere. And the people at the end of the supply chain who receive goods on pallets have nothing to do with them, and they become quite a nuisance. So it's at this point that these pallet recyclers spring up.
Well, you talk about the world known as Whitewood, and there are 40,000 citizens of this this notional community, and they range from pallet pickers who salvage pallets from the trash to recyclers who repair broken ones and make them whole. On and on it goes.
Yeah, that's right. So once these guys start picking up pallets from wherever they end up, this whole sort of world grows in complexity and becomes more interesting. People who are just are in proximity to pallets, garbage men, truck drivers, other small businessmen, all have this moment of recognition. Everyone I've ever talked to who works in pallets has this moment when they realize that, you know, the pallet is going to become a part of their life. And that's how this world kind of expanded into this wonderful, messy ecosystem where pallets are being traded, pallets are being broken down and rebuilt, and it's all very, very small, very simple mom and pop kind of businesses.
I've got to ask you this: where does the wood come from initially? Purpose planted forests?
The best I can tell you is it comes from the lumber mill, and it's the cheapest stuff you can get from the mill. It's known colloquially as bark and better. I don't know. No, I couldn't point you to the forest in question.
Okay, Jacob, but I just had to ask. Now, would you tell me, please, about Ricky Mock?
Yes, Ricky Mock is the quintessential American pallet man, at least in my mind. He grew up on a farm in Georgia, and he got into pallets. He had his moment when he was cutting down trees on his parents' hog farm and started wondering if there wasn't some better, easier way to get some wood to feed their wood-burning stoves and so on. And he saw an ad in the newspaper for free shipping pallets. And he followed up. He sort of realized how useful these things could be. He satisfied all his own needs on his farm, like I guess you have on your farm. But still there were more pallets. So he continues sort of hoarding these pallets until he has
300,000.
Yes, yes. If you flash forward to make, shorten the story, he gets up. At one point, he told me he had 1 million, but late in the fact-checking process, he backed off that number a little bit. So we went with 300,000. He's got this massive yard of pallets, and for 20 years, he just kept expanding and expanding, and he would pave over or pour concrete over what had been, rolling farmland, if you imagine it, and just building this sort of city of pallets. And if you imagine them in stacks, 30 or 40, 50 feet high of just these old wooden pallets, and the stacks grow and fall over time. And he's doing quite well as a small businessman, selling these to everyone in the area.
I'm talking to the great explainer of pallets, Jacob Hodes, Brooklyn-based writer, and this is LNL on RN. Okay, let's go back to the Australian company, CHEP. Its pallets are blue. We'll talk about the significance of this in a moment. But how are blue pallets different from pallets of white wood?
Yes, well, the key thing is that CHEP, the blue pallet, is a rental pallet. So unlike the pallet of white wood, which courses its way through the economy and changes hands and changes ownership many times, the blue pallet is owned and maintained by CHEP, at least notionally, throughout its life.
And it's slightly better quality, isn't it? So it can have a longer life.
Yeah, the economics are a little bit different. It may or may not be made with different wood, but the actual, do you want to get into the sort of structural differences? How nerdy are we going?
Sorry, say that again?
I said, yeah, if you want, we can get nerdy and actually talk about the sort of structural differences in the way they're built.
Yeah, no, I think we'll take that as a given. Now, yeah. What happened when CHEP, which came to Australia via the U.S., entered the U.S. market in 1990?
All hell broke loose.
That's a very clipped answer. Can you describe all hell?
Yeah. Well, so as I said, right, it's a different model where they a closed loop. So these blue pallets are supposed to circulate and not certainly not fall into the hands of recyclers who...
Mate, would you hang up? We're going to call you back because you're now becoming almost unintelligible, which is a great shame because I'm enjoying it. So we'll get straight back to you. And once again, dear listener, I'll be talking to Brooklyn-based writer Jacob Hodes about the pallet industry in the US. And remember that CHEP doesn't sell pallets, it rents them, and therefore... it's a business model which must have upset Ricky Mock very, very much indeed. And Ricky takes CHEP to court to get compensation for the blue CHEP pallets he'd had. And do we have Jacob back? Not quite. Okay. LNL on RN, and this is a budget-free program. You'd have to drag me kicking and struggling to that topic. And I'm most reluctant to mention it as he watches the other side of the great big glass window to see what, if anything, is occurring. Still got troubles? Okay. Jacob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I've filled the listener in your absence about Ricky Mock taking CHEP to court to get compensation. So can we pick it up at that point in the story?
Yes, yes. So the blue pallets just start showing up where they're not supposed to, which is in the yards of folks like Ricky Mock. And Mock refuses to give them back, at which point CHEP becomes very aggressive in trying to recover their blue pallets. And the story of this court trial is, I gotta say, pretty fantastic. We hear about the lengths to which CHEP would go to try to recover these pallets. Even at one point, the judge is really impressed by the tenacity of the asset recovery team is
and,
the
and often the group. Often we're talking about pallets in absolutely deteriorated condition, but that didn't stop CHEP demanding them back.
That's right. You know, these pallet yards, if you picture them, they're not enclosed. They're open to the sky, so the pallets get rained on, snowed on, and et cetera. So they do decay over time, particularly if you're Ricky Mock and you're not interested in caring for these enemy pallets.
Now, currently, CHEP pays recyclers $1.25 for the return of a pallet, plus up to, well, almost $2 more if the recycler transports the pallet to a CHEP depot. So it's like having a deposit on a bottle, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And from the recycler's point of view, it's interesting because they don't necessarily have a choice to give that pallet back unless they want to take CHEP on in court, which it would be a major undertaking.
And is this being echoed around the world? Because, you know, there are now huge markets for pallets in China, for example, or in India.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I don't know. My research has been very parochially focused on the United States, but folks,
well, in India, yeah, they use elephants as forklifts. You see. They come along and slide their tusks under the pallet and lift them up. Now, you didn't know that. You had to come on this funny little program to discover this amazing truth.
Okay. I'm a big fan of your program, I have to tell you.
Well, you know, we're infinitely curious, and people like you delight and amuse me. Now, recyclers argue that the accumulation of blue pellets in their yards is a deliberate CHEP strategy.
Yes, that's right. So, notionally, CHEP tracks its pallets, and the people who rent them are in charge of getting them back where they belong. But the interesting thing is a system like this inevitably leaks. So if you walk around, for example, New York City, you see blue pallets, and you know they're not supposed to be where they are, but they are. They show up everywhere. You can see them. If you go for a hike in the woods, you'll see one in a ravine.
And a bit like supermarket trolleys.
Yeah, right. And so you've got these two economies side by side, the Whitewood economy, which is all about gathering up these stray pallets and then profiting off that work. CHEP's economy is supposed to operate entirely separately, but where those two sort of systems meet, it gets very messy and contentious about who owns what, who gets compensated for what labor, at what rates, et cetera.
I get a feeling, and we've got to wind it up now, but I get a feeling that you're very sympathetic to the white wood and not completely besotted with the blue ones.
You know, that's right. My journalistic objectivity may have been compromised at some point along the way. Certainly for aesthetics, the aesthetics of the Whitewood pallets are incomparably superior to the blues. I don't know if anyone would disagree with that.
Well, on that uplifting and, shall we say, biased note, I take my leave of you. Jacob, thanks a lot for that. Brooklyn-based writer,
it's been a pleasure.
Jacob Hodes. If you want to read more about the world of Whitewood in the US and how it's under siege from these terrible Australians, we've got a link to Jacob's story on our website, and this is Linnell on Run. And after a little bit of music played by Paul on his ukulele, I'll be talking to Yasmin El-Rashidi about the battle for Egypt.